Welcome to History 101, Lecture 8, The Rise of Northern Eurasia. Now the reason why I stressed in the previous lecture that given a bit more luck, given a bit more time, Iran might have well transformed itself to a centralized state with a modern army and an industrial economy, a Eurasian great power. Was that over the course of the 17th and 18th centuries a power which was even more alien, nay, I dare say, more Asian to Western Europeans than Iran, Russia, managed to transform itself into one of the world's most powerful countries, and was thus more or less reluctantly admitted into Europe as the great power it not only is, but is likely to remain. Now the image Europeans had from the 16th century onward of Russia is really already present in the very earliest descriptions of what the Europeans then still called the Grand Duchy of Muscovy, in the 17th century called the Muscovian Tsardom, and only in the 18th century began to call the Russian Empire, although Tsar Ivan III had already called himself Tsar and Grand Duke of all of Russia in 1516, in a very similar way as when the place was called the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, everybody persisted in calling it Russia. So this view is already present in Jules Fletcher's Of the Commonwealth of Muscovy from 1591. And it was classically formulated by the Marquis de Custine in 1824 as follows: the government of this land devours all that is weak, all who are not stupid die, and merely the debased survive. Russia was seen as the beehive, a vast mass of mindless drones, all directed by a single mother or father bee. The Russian autocrat, with a mindless body of servants willing to obey any and all of his commands, and without any constitutional body to stem his power. This was then supposed to be typically Asian, or still worse, Tartar. As one of Fletcher's embassy members already rhymed, their manners are so Turkish-like, the men so full of guile, the women wanton, temples stuffed with idols that defile, the seats that sacred ought to be, the customs so quaint, that were I to describe it all, my pen would faint. And again, this view of Russia as the beehive has persisted right unto the present. Basically, in the 1950s, when people were talking about the West versus the East, what they meant was not the West against Islam or China, as rather the West against despotic Russia, or merely a newer version of an idea that also already dates back into the 16th century, Eastern slavery. And since that word West has become so loaded with value judgments during the Cold War, I would urge the utmost caution using it. Now the Russians themselves too have long agonized on how Asian, how Tartar, or how European their country was. In the 18th century, it was beyond any doubt that Russia was European, and the Russian literature of that period is full of scathing references to Asians. However, in the 19th century, Russian intellectuals began increasingly to fall apart in two groups: the Westernizers and the Slavophiles. Westernizers, indeed the entire administration since Peter the Great, the Slavophiles argued, had become colonizers of their own country, men who sought to impose alien values upon the Russian people, namely an individualistic worldview that completely isolated man, and in which, quote, the external legal relations of private property counted for far more than human beings. Whereas in Orthodoxy, the Slavophiles argued, a feeling of community prevailed. Orthodoxy was a moral bond based on traditions and customs in which every individual had his own happy place. Russia was to the Slavophiles neither European nor Asian. It had its own Russian values. It was a Eurasian power. That was a view that was later on endorsed by Russian historians who had fled from the revolution into exile in the United States or England. For example, the Ukrainian historian George Vernadsky, lately of jail, who argued that Russia was not a national state, was dominated by a single people, as rather a complex of people who together collaborated and should collaborate in erecting a single great culture. A culture that, as it were, represented the very best of all nationalities, whether that be Ukrainian or Russian or Tatar or Georgian. For this reason, Vernadsky rejected both Russian nationalist historians who had written the history of Eurasia exclusively as that of Russians, and Ukrainian nationalists that sought to tear Ukraine from this wider Eurasian unit. That would merely lead, in his appreciation, to both the intellectual and the material impoverishment of the Ukraine as much as of Russia. In the 1990s, the issue of Russia's European or Asianness led to an acrimonious debate, if that's the term, for what was more like a mutual consignation of the opponents to the deepest circles of hell, between on the one hand the Europeanizers, such as the then Prime Minister Yegor Gaidar, who argued that Russia naturally belonged to Europe and the West, and should therefore import European institutions wholesale. All attempts to find a proper Russian way, having ended in disaster from Ivan the Great to Stalin, and the Eurasianists on the other side, such as the secretary of the Russian Communist Party, Gennady Zhuganov, or the head of the sociology department of Moscow University, Alexander Dugin. They argued that Russia should stand apart from the model of globalization that was proposed by the USA. Rather, it should serve as a bridge between Europe and Asia, and it should lead a broad movement to resist the leveling impact of globalization. Such a movement should be based on a dialogue between cultures in the Eurasian space instead. Dugin called it the Eurasian movement. While the Europeanizers were on the ascent in the 90s, recently the pendulum seems to have swung in the Eurasian direction. Vladimir Putin, at least, lately declared that Russia has always considered itself as a Eurasian nation. Whatever one's opinions about all this, particularly if one wants to respect the historic agency of the non-Russian people inhabiting Siberia or the steppe lands, Russia is indeed not a very appropriate term, as it, after all, confines the history of Russia to Russian people alone. Dealing with Siberia, I would rather speak of Russia as northern Eurasia. Now, to return to the 17th century, the idea of the beehive finds support in 17th century Muscovian propaganda. Even in a book on domestic housekeeping, the Domostroy, not a particularly good book for feminists, as it advises you should beat your wife constantly, argues, fear the Tsar and serve him faithfully. Tell him the truth as if you speak to God. If you serve the earthly king righteously, you will learn to fear the heavenly king as well. Submit yourself to the prince, for they are God's agents for punishment, for retribution on the offender, and for showering rewards on those who do good. Yet there are three problems in perceiving Muscovy in the 17th century as a uniquely subservient society. First, and most obviously, since the country was vast, there were plenty of opportunities for servants of the Tsar to delay or avoid any of his ukases. God is on high, and the Tsar is far off, as they said in Russia. Second, Muscovy's bureaucracy in the 16th and 17th century was, to put it mildly, rudimentary. Between them, it consisted of 800 persons to watch over an area the size of Europe. In comparison to the elaborate impersonal bureaucracies West European states were erecting in the same period, Muscovy was both undergoverned and indeed undertaxed. Thirdly, in the 30s and 40s, Soviet Marxist historians, who obviously subscribed to the then-current Marxist idea that all societies had to pass through stages from slavery to feudalism into capitalism, argued that Muscovy was feudal, and that therefore the power in the land belonged to a feudal aristocracy, the boyars, of whom a typical group picture is shown in the illustration to this lecture, whom the Tsars, and especially Tsar Ivan the Great, Groshny, who was seen as a national hero under Stalin's reign, fought with more or less success. Therefore, he fulfilled an objectively progressive role in the then current terminology. Now, over the past few decades, Western scholars have tried to show that rather than being an independent nobility, the boyars were in fact entirely subservient to all the Tsar's wishes. Nay, they were appointed by the Tsar, and they had no independent power of their own. And they have tried to show, very much in particular, that Ivan Groshny's unique attempt to split Muscovy in two kingdoms, one for the Tsar and one for the boyars, Lopriznina, resulted from a fit of idiocy on Ivan Groshny's part, rather than from any well-calculated policy to break the feudal power in the land. I find this a very unconvincing explanation. Even if Ivan had become mad, and even if he delighted in killing people, and he surely did, I still find it hard to explain why tens of thousands would have rallied to Ivan's cause, or indeed, would have enlisted in his secret police, the dreaded Oprichnika, organized as a monastic order, unless there was some reason for it. Namely, that, as the older Soviet explanations held, people indeed resented the yoke of the landlords, and that Ivan indeed perceived the boyars as a countervailing power in the land which should be broken at all costs. In which case, Oprichnina was merely a kind of variant on the former, though surely carried out with characteristic Russian ruthlessness. For Russia could ill afford dissent. It then, as now, was pervaded by a notion of sacrifice and victimhood, in which the people would be slaughtered by the Mongols, or the Tatars, or the Teutonic Knights, unless offering a united front against the invaders. This is partly true too. Even in the 16th century, Moscow itself was repeatedly raided by Crimean Tatars, burning entire neighborhoods and dragging the inhabitants away as slaves. Partly too, however, it is part of a peculiarly Russian national myth, in which the Russians are Christ's chosen people, chosen to maintain orthodoxy against foes coming from the Catholic West as much as the Islamic East. And it appears too, as if this particular myth that all Russians had the duty to maintain the Orthodox faith, that if you do not want to call it nationalist, you may at least call proto-nationalist, served to cement a particularly strong tie amongst the population. A strong tie that gradually made Russia into the strong state of Eastern Europe. For Ruthenian serfs under some Polish-speaking landlord in Ukraine had nothing in common with one another. In fact, the entire emphasis on liberty in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth only served to pull them ever further apart, since, as we saw in the previous lecture, the Szlachta even argued they were of completely different Sarmatian descent than their serfs. Russian serfs, on the other hand, could feel they were united by the boyars, in that they had both to obey the heavenly and the earthly lord. Now, aside from this peculiar early nationalism, what other typical characteristics did Muscovy have that made it ultimately to one of the world's major powers? I would distinguish four, where I ought to emphasize the first one is a bit speculative. First, as I've said already, the period from 1350 onwards was a period of extreme cold in Eurasia. Yet on the precise effects of this on Russia, we are as yet not particularly well informed, although the issue is of obvious significance, as Russia, after all, is located on the very edge of the zone where agriculture is still possible. We know, of course, the 14th century was an extremely grim period in Russia, in which both agriculture and trade was in utter disarray. However, that is generally blamed on the Mongols. Yet while I would be the very last to slight the Mongol tyranny, I think the Little Ice Age at least contributed to this crisis as well. What seems to have happened is that one ancient core of Russia, Novgorod, in the extreme north, that is, after all, at the same latitude as Greenland, became too cold for agriculture, whereas the other core, Kiev, was suffering from climatic extremes. For though the Ukraine is blessed with the famous fertile black earth, the Chernozem, it is also a land of extremes. Either there is too much rain and everything turns into a swamp, or there is no rain at all. Either there is extreme heat, or there is extreme cold. Marshal Franz Halder of the German army in the Second World War said that climate in Russia is nothing but a series of natural disasters. During the Little Ice Age, these climatic swings were particularly violent. As one zone of Russia became too cold and one too unreliable, the focus of Russian population shifted towards the forest belt that lays in between them. Now the forest belt of central Russia is a land of very poor, sandy soil, technically known podzol. And because the humus layer is so thin, it does not lend itself for a heavy plow, but only for a very light plow, the soka, mostly horse-drawn, and the results very meager harvest yields too. In Russia, yields of 2 or 3 to 1 were still common in the 19th century, lower than in Western Europe in the 8th. However, on the one hand, the soka is far less labor-intensive than a European plow. And on the other hand, Russian peasants might replenish the meager yields of their fields by gathering fruits in the forests. As some listeners may be aware, the whole of urban Russia still goes to the forest in autumn to gather mushrooms. And furthermore, the meager revenues of the fields could be replenished by hunting and fishing. In other words, Western European agriculture, ever since the medieval agricultural revolution, required a lot of labor to attain a good yield from a small field. Russian agriculture yielded much less, but it cultivated more fields. One form was labor intensive, the other labor extensive. Nor, in fact, were Russian serfs so much worse off than poor peasants in, say, the Languedoc or the Basilicata. European travelogues all agree that even Russian serfs were commonly tall, well-nourished people. By Richard Halley, in a huge study that deserves to be far better known than it is, shows that in general, people in Russia led reasonably comfortable lives in the 17th century. The consequence of all that was, however, that Russian agriculture needed space. It was, as it were, both space-extensive and labor-extensive. European agriculture, by contrast, let alone Chinese or Indian, was space-intensive and labor-intensive. One of the oft-repeated verities about Russia is that from 1500 to 1800, it annually added a territory the size of the Netherlands to its territory. Partly, that was no doubt the imperial expansionism everybody in Europe was afraid of, though most of the territory, to be sure, consisted of virgin taiga. But it also flowed from the logic of Russian agriculture itself. Russian expansion did not follow the same kind of rules as that of the Spanish in Mexico or Peru. In whatever area the Russians had conquered that was usable for soka cultivation, Russian colonists followed, mostly fleeing the regime of serfdom in the core areas of Russia that was at least initially mostly not imposed on newly conquered territory. In other words, this was not an expansion of conquistadors, aiming to put up encomiendas, worked by, say, Tartar or Kuryak serfs, as rather one of mixed warrior traders, mercenary bands, followed by the troops and authorities of the Tsar, and then followed by bands of peasants, who surely seized land from the native foreign inhabitants, as the Russians called non-Russian people, but in general did not really aim to chase them off their land. Rather, they came to live next to them, as for example was the case in 17th century Kazan, where Russian peasants came to live next to Tartar or Chuvash people, Tartars being herders and craftsmen, the Chuvash hunters in the forests, and the Russian peasants had laid out their own plot. Nor was there any drive to convert the Tartars or the Chuvash. Indeed, 452 years after its conquest by Russia, 65% of the population of the Tartar Republic on the middle Volga, with Kazan as its capital, is still Tartar, and it is an all-Islamic place besides. To which may be added that, and completely contrary to the pattern of Anglo-Saxon settlement colonies, Tartar nobility were immediately after the conquest of Kazan already accepted as boyars and allotted equal positions to Russian boyars. Thus, famously, Ivan IV's successor, Boris Godunov, was of Tartar descent. Later on again, Russia was only too glad to absorb German-speaking Baltic nobility into its rank. Whereas the great Pyotr Bagration, commander at the Battle of Borodino, later on the 12th, was of Georgian noble descent. Second, to this must be added yet a second unique characteristic of Russia, namely that it completely diverged from the European demographic pattern, unlike everywhere else in Europe, and for that matter, amongst the Finnish and Latvian minorities who had a very different demographic pattern too. In Russia, people married young. Women at 16, men at 18, and they had large families of 6 to 7 children. This is a critical matter, but we do not frankly know why that was so. Maybe the Orthodox Church propagated large families. Maybe too, it has to do with inheritance. Since whereas in Western Europe, land fell to the eldest son, in Russia, it fell to all sons together. Whatever the cause, this caused constant population pressure on the older settled lands, which, though they might appear almost empty to Western Europeans, were, in the perception of Russian peasants, too thickly populated to allow sons a reasonable piece of land they could cultivate, and they would have to move elsewhere. Because of all this, Russian villages were, as it were, self-replicating cells that reproduced the same pattern elsewhere. The consequence of all this was that Russia had from the 16th century onward the fastest growing population of all of Europe. And this produced a large and always land-hungry population ready to be sent off to the imperial frontier. The third distinguished characteristic of Russia was that it was almost exclusively rural in the 17th century, likely 90%, and in the beginning of the 19th century, even 92% of Russian population lived in the countryside. There was only one, but a major exception, Moscow, as basically all boyars and their hangers-on had to have a residence in Moscow, though they lived most of their time on their estates in the countryside. So Moscow may have supported about 200,000-300,000 inhabitants in the 17th century, and was one of the major cities of Europe. Yet all other cities were little more than overgrown villages. Even Russia's second most important city, and the commercial hub of the Russian north, Novgorod, sported no more than 8,000 inhabitants in the 17th century. Furthermore, manufacturing, and there was a great deal of it in Moscow, was typically spread in the countryside rather than in cities as well. And since the cities were so small, they were barely separated from the countryside. Whereas in Europe, if you moved to a city, you were a serf no longer. In Russia, you remained a serf, and most craftsmen in the cities were serfs too, though many of them prospered. And cities in Russia did not exist as separate legal entities. The emperor had no, or very little, authority in Hamburg, but that was certainly not true for the Tsar in Novgorod. Now, the great National Socialist Austrian historian Otto Brunner has made a great deal of this. While European democracy was developed in the cities, he argued, Russian cities lacked any sense of coherence, and therefore Russia failed to develop democratic institutions as well. That is partly true. Western European democracy owes a great deal more to the urban revolution of the 11th and 12th century than it does to the Greeks. And cities always remained virtually autonomous in Western Europe, even during the age of so-called absolutism, while any remaining trace of urban freedom was extinguished in Muscovy in the 15th century, as its final bastion, Novgorod, that had been ruled by an urban assembly, the Viech, very similar to the ones existing in Western Europe, fell to Muscovy in 1478, and Ivan Grozny and his Opritsniki slaughtered the remaining urban nobility of Novgorod in 1570. Yet if Russia lacked democratic institutions in the cities, it had actually democratic institutions in the countryside. The village assembly courts, called the Mir, that decided on a wide variety of issues, from charity to widows, to the apportioning of land. Thus Russia was in some ways as democratic, arguably more so, than Europe, since, as we saw already, the peasant democracy of Europe were gradually being emasculated from the 16th century onward. And in fact, a separate group of Russian revolutionaries, called the Friends of the People, or the Narodniki, later in the 19th century, argued that the Mir should become the cornerstone to the construction of a truly Slavic democracy, unlike those imported Western ideas of representative democracy. And since the cities were so small, Russia too lacked a self-conscious bourgeoisie in the literal European sense of people living in the cities, to which must be added that much, if not most, of the commercial activity in Russia, even including banking, was in Muscovy monopolized by the church. Thus the monastery of St. Sergiev, presently located in the Moscow suburb of Sergiev Posad, had its own fields, its own mills, its own ships, its own fisheries, salt, pens, and the list goes on and on. While the economy of the inhospitable north was virtually completely controlled by monasteries, Russia thus had a smaller bourgeoisie than Europe. And the Tsar's administration also ran far more enterprises itself than was common in Western Europe, a tradition it was surely to carry on into the 20th and indeed the 21st century. We should, however, not make too much of this, because on the one hand, almost all trade of Russia was run by Russian merchants, and the crown had allowed middling merchants special status, as the so-called Posadsky Lyud, by which urban crafts and urban trades were to be reserved for people from that town, so that Russia's bourgeoisie, however small it was certainly not entirely bereft of privileges. And on the other hand, there was a top layer of ultra-wealthy merchants, only a few dozen people, who were officially recognized as state merchants, goshti, and allowed far-reaching privileges and allowances by the Tsar to conduct foreign trade. The Swedish merchant Kilberger described them in 1670 as a self-interested and harmful group who seek to cheat their master to fill their own pockets. They were, in short, just like the modern Russian oligarchs, and are clearly their distant ancestors. Though, like the modern oligarchs, the Goshti were under the constant watchful eyes of the Tsar, and exactly like the modern oligarchs, they needed occasional punishment, lest they became too arrogant. Though, obviously, the Muscovy, the ultra-rich, were still the Boyar families, who in the 16th and 17th century spent most of their time fighting. But in the 19th century, they began to spew forward lofty thought, just like the European nobility in that period, such as, for example, the Tolstoy and Volgonsky family, whose son, Lev, had really so much money that he never had to bother working for a living. Unlike, say, the impoverished Lithuanian noble family of Dostoevsky, who, although noble too, had become so impoverished that they had to lower themselves to becoming merchants, while their son, Fyodor, had to eke out a living, buried by family debts as a journalist. Fourth, Russia's position in the emerging world economy of the 16th century was rather singular, as it faced both East and West, and, as I said already, it was one of the main beneficiaries of all the silver potosi showered on the world economy after 1550, and in particular as it delivered three critical products, flax, wood, both too critical for shipbuilding, and furs, and all three were very big trades, involving absolutely massive amounts of profits. 200-300% profits were common in the fur trade. Every year, about 10,000 sables were exported via Arkhangelsk, with the numbers topping at 100,000 in the 1640s. Of course, the same period, as we shall see in a moment, when Siberia was being unlocked. To which may be added the occasional bulk deliveries of grain, which the Dutch merchant tycoons of the Trippen occasionally used to break the monopoly of Gdansk on the grain trade, whereas Russia traded eastwards in fish and furs to Persia and the Ottoman Empire. Russia had in principle huge opportunities for commercial gains, yet it saw its access to its markets blocked by hostile powers, by the Khanate of the Crimea to the ports in the Black Seas, by the Khanates of Kazan and Astrakhan to the ports on the Caspian Seas, and last, but certainly not least, to the west, by what remained of the Teutonic Knights, and by the Duchy of Courland, a very odd construction of German-speaking aristocrats lording over a mass of Estonian-speaking serfs, and later on by the great rising power of the 16th and 17th century, Sweden. Sweden in the 17th century is in many ways reminiscent of Israel nowadays. Like Israel, it was a very small country in population, of course, not in size, with less than 800,000 inhabitants, which, as could be expected, was particularly badly hit by the Little Ice Age that made most of Sweden unsuitable for agriculture, and the only good farmland of Sweden lay in the utmost south, Skåne. That was, however, until 1658, a Danish possession. However, in the 17th century, during the reign of Gustav Adolf, Sweden developed the most modern and the best-equipped army of Europe. Drafted, Swedish innovation, by conscription of all males from 17 to 45. And just like Israel is kept afoot, whatever the Israelis may think, by US financial support, so too Sweden was kept afoot by the constant support of the major financial power of that period, the Dutch Republic. Sweden's army was funded by Dutch bankers, who in turn obtained a monopoly on the exports of high-grade Swedish iron, that was then as critical for armaments as it is now, and of copper, that too was primarily used for making cannons. And again, just like Israel, Sweden had by the early 17th century adopted the rule that its neighbors were to pay its war expenses, so that by the 1650s, Sweden had conquered all Baltic ports, blocking Russian access to the Baltic. As mentioned, the only port Russia had was Arkhangelsk, blocked by ice for half a year. Now, under Ivan Groznyi, Russia, to get out of that encirclement, had first turned on the very weakest of its neighbors, the Khanate of Kazan, that was conquered in 1552. On the occasion of this, Ivan Groznyi commissioned the Kazan Cathedral on Red Square. It was, of course, to become the landmark of Russia. However, the prolonged attempt to secure a port on the Baltic turned into a disastrous failure, as Muscovy became involved in a lengthy war with Poland and Sweden that it could both militarily not match. For, somewhat like in Poland, but unlike in Sweden, the Russian army was originally an army intended to fight steppenwolves. It mainly consisted of heavy cavalry made up of the boyars and those aspiring to boyar status and the body of their serfdom. The boyars then being assigned pieces of land to feed that retinue. In the 1550s, Ivan IV then put up a regular corps of musketeers, the streltsy, shooters, who were directly paid by the state and who grew into the main force of the Muscovian army by 1580. However, as streltsy were badly or not paid, expected to subsist from their own farm, were not regularly drilled, and the streltsy position was hereditary, with many streltsy subsisting as peddlers or shopkeepers between military campaigns, they were a very poor force that commonly made a poor showing too. In addition to which, as they were after all irregularly or not paid, streltsy were particularly prone to mutiny. Ivan left two sons, both minor, Fyodor and Dmitri. Fyodor named Boris Godunov as the regent, as he was mentally impaired. Dmitri, whom Godunov had banished to the small town of Uglitz, died there under suspicious circumstances. And when Fyodor suddenly died too, in 1598, indeed, it all looked suspiciously like murder, as Alexander Pushkin argued in a play, subsequently made to an opera by Modest Mussorgsky, but then people died a lot from natural causes in the 16th century. Godunov was proclaimed by the National Assembly, the Zemsky Sobor, to Tsar. Godunov, however, suddenly died in 605, and his son was ousted by a coup of boyars. That allowed the pretender to the throne, the so-called False Dmitri, to seize control of the Kremlin. He was in turn overthrown in 606. Vasily Shuisky, a distant member of the ruling dynasty, then mounted the throne. Then a second pretender claimed the throne, supported by Poland. And, on defeating a Russian force, the Polish-Lithuanian army in 1610 briefly occupied Moscow. That is an episode the Poles generally see as the high point of their Commonwealth, on condition they were to maintain orthodoxy. But As the Polish king then began to covet a throne for himself and dreamt about converting Russia to Catholicism, in 1612 there was an uprising in Moscow in which the Polish troops in the Kremlin capitulated on 4 November, a date that was made a national holiday under Putin, although nobody in Russia has any idea what that holiday is supposed to celebrate. The Great Assembly of the Land, the Zemsky Sobor, then elected the son of Patriarch Mikhail Romanov to new Tsar. Even in brief compass, this is a very complicated story. And in details, it is still 100 times more complicated. This period, the Troubles were as smooth as it became known, was one of the worst periods in Russian history. For 7 years, all central authority broke down, boyar for boyar, while ransacking Tatar and Cossack bands ravaged the land. It is estimated up to 1/3 of Russia's population may have perished during the Troubles. On the one hand, this period has left scars until the very present day. If Russians prefer a strong, even if authoritarian, government, then to some extent that has to do with the fear that without a strong government, Russia might risk falling apart, as it did during the Troubles. It took Russia most of the rest of the 17th century to entirely recover. Yet on the other hand, Russia was henceforth determined to take its revenge on Poland. To put it bluntly, as Poland had tried to take Russia apart, Russia would not stop until it had taken Poland apart. So in 1632, Muscovy tried to take the fortress of Smolensk from the Poles without much success. However, in 1648, a Cossack hetman, Bogdan Khmelnytsky, decided to lead a revolt against the Poles, supported by the Crimean Khanate, and then, all over the Ukraine, a massive revolt of the serfs broke out, wherever they found shlakta, royal officers, or Jews. The rebels slaughtered them. Nobody had his hands not soaked in blood, a chronicle of the time commented. And Khmelnytsky's army utterly routed a Polish army that had been sent out to punish him. While all over Poland it was said, if only God would give us another Khmelnytsky, then we, the serfs, could finally punish the nobles. Christmas 1648, Khmelnytsky made a triumphant entry into Kiev, hailed as Moses, Savior, Redeemer, Liberator of the people from Polish captivity. Khmelnytsky's initial successes were, however, followed by a long series of setbacks, as neither Khmelnytsky nor the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth had enough strength to stabilize the situation. From the spring of 1649, the situation turned for the worse for the Cossacks, and they were crushingly defeated at the Battle of Bierestetsko in 1651, where the Tatars betrayed Khmelnytsky. In search for a new ally, he approached the Ottoman Sultan. The Turks offered vassalships, similar to their older arrangements with the Crimea, Moldavia, and Wallachia. However, the idea of a union with a Muslim monarch was not acceptable to the population. The only other possible ally was Orthodox Russia. The government initially hesitated, in spite of numerous envoys and call for help. However, the threat of a Cossack-Ottoman union finally forced Tsar Alexei into action. After a series of negotiations, it was agreed that the Cossacks would accept overlordship of Tsar Alexei. So in October 1653, the Zemsky Sobor formally declared war on the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, and in June 1654, forces of Russia invaded the eastern half of Poland-Lithuania, starting the Russo-Polish War that lasted from 1654 to 1667. In the summer of 1654, the Russians managed to capture most important cities of today's Belarus. Sweden then invaded too, and it occupied the remaining half of Poland. In a long series of battles, the Poles, with the critical support of Austria, eventually managed to evict the Russians and the Swedes from Poland. And by 1665, they had managed to recover most of their lost territory. Yet the Lelouch, as it was called afterwards, utterly ravaged Poland. At least a quarter of the population of the four core Polish provinces perished, and the power in the Polish monarchy now passed entirely into the hands of the Szlachta, while the Poles had to declare Prussia to an independent state, and Prussia would emerge under the rule of Friedrich Wilhelm, the great elector, as a kind of Sweden on steroids and a constant threat to Poland. And on the other hand, the Poles had come to rely entirely on Austrian aid to clear Poland of both the Russians and the Swedes, so that it became, in fact, an Austrian puppet. The Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was still to have its last and its greatest moment in history, the legendary great ride of Polish hussars from Krakow to relieve Vienna that was on the verge of being taken by the Turks in 1683. Yet that was to prove the last gasp of the once so powerful and the once so glorious Commonwealth, while Russia was on the ascent. And next to the decline of Poland, in two other ways too, Russia began to emerge as a great power in the 17th century, before the reign of Peter the Great already. To put it bluntly, Peter speeded up things, but without him, Russia would have emerged as a great power anyway. First, Russia became already tightly linked to Western European economies in the 17th century. However, and critically, from a position of strength, it wasn't a case of foreign merchants moving in and taking over the entire economy. Yet in the 17th century, Muscovy was already awash with German, Swedish, or Dutch merchants who were seeking to gather quick bucks there, either from Muscovy's caviar, its furs, or its wood. And, as Russian serfs were paid much less than Dutch, Swedish, or German workers, already in the 17th century there was a flurry of speculative schemes to put up industrial enterprises in Russia. Most of those never got off the ground and left neither a trace nor any money to those capable enough to have invested in them. Yet Dutch entrepreneurs indeed put up a flourishing armament industry in Russia, though, to be sure, they, like indeed almost all foreigners, utterly detested Russia. One of them made the following rhyme: churches, crosses, icon bells, painted horse and garlic smells, vice and vodka every place, that's Moscow's daily face. Thieving, murdering, fornication are so common in this nation, no one thinks a brow to raise, such are Moscow's sordid days. Some things never change, I might add. For exactly like now, those foreigners were under the constant surveillance of spies and informers of the Russian state, and they were locked up in their own neighborhood, called Nemetsky Svoboda. That word was later on politely translated as the German neighborhood. But it actually means the dummy's place, that is, place for people who are so stupid they can't even speak Russian. For then, much as now, Russians either speak a foreign language fluently, or they don't speak it at all. Yet all these foreigners had a, what might be called, corrosive effect on both the Russian clergy and the Russian elites. There was one group of cautious modernizers, such as Princes Romanovsky, Galitzin, or Peter the Great's teacher, Simeon Polotsky, who argued that if Moscow was to defeat Sweden, it should adopt Swedish institutions. On the other side were a group of conservatives, who argued that Orthodoxy should under no circumstance yield to Roman Catholic heresy, for those new thoughts primarily filtered into Russia via the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, and via the University of Vilnius and Kiev in particular, and those universities were completely dominated by the Jesuits. In other words, while there is no denying the magnetic effect of Peter the Great, it is very likely Russia would have followed a very similar path of westernization if he had not existed. It had already become too closely integrated within the capitalist world system to follow any other path. Second, and paradoxically, in the times of the Troubles, and likely very much because of the Troubles, as they unleashed hordes of desperados who might otherwise have stayed at home, or more precisely, would have been laying on the stove, as people do during the long Russian winter, Russia transformed itself to a true continental superpower during the 17th century. Historian John Wills rightly calls it the greatest global geopolitical transformation of that age. It began, if things, of course, ever begin, for Novgorod hunters and merchants were already exploring the upper reaches of the Ob River in the 15th century with the expedition of yet another former highwayman, Shostaknat Irsha, Cossack headman Timofeyev Yermak, who was, in 1582, engaged by Russia's wealthiest merchant house, the Stroganov family, and yes, Beef Stroganov is named after that family, for a scouting expedition into the Khaganate of Sibir, one of the split-off branches of the Golden Horde. Yermak, with his firearms, more or less to everybody's amazement, not in the least to that of Boris Godunov, who had absolutely nothing to do with all that, defeated a much larger army of the Khaganate, who had never seen firearms, and they panicked. The cutthroat of the Volga, English historian John Baddeley observed about it, was afterwards transformed by the Russians into a shining knight of arms, a happy mixture of Cortez and King Arthur, with a mix of Sir Galahad added. He surely did not deserve that, though he was no vulgar leader of a band of brigands either. In 1586, Godunov finally sent out a party of Streltsy to the new land, and the new government, called Siberia, was pronounced from the newly founded town of Tobolsk in 1587. And from Tobolsk, men driven by ambition, a love of danger, and sheer greed, began to fan out over the vast, nay virtually immeasurable, unknown behind it, looking for gold, but especially for furs from the Siberian sables. And all this was such a hurry that it was as if they were driven by fear that the land would soon fall to an enemy forever, and that they had to scoop out everything the enemy might take. And as one area ran out of fur, they rapidly moved on to the next one. At every new place they entered, the inhabitants were gathered and told that they were henceforth subjects of the Tsar, in a manner of, as one report stated, "We came upon two tents of reindeer herding koryaks, and we tenderly told them they were henceforth under the hands of the Tsar, and they would then, instead of having to pay taxes, have to collect a stipulated number of furs." It was called, with a Mongol loanword, Yasak. The natives had then subsequently to swear a solemn oath of subjection to the Tsar, by the sun, by the fire, by the Russian guns. Such an oath of subjection ran: "If I break this oath, I will not walk the earth. I will not eat bread, or Russian guns will strike me down." And the Siberian tribes were to deliver a couple of hostages to the Russians, commonly the most important man of the tribe. Later on, as the system became better organized, the newly instated Siberian administration in Tobolsk maintained Yasak books, in which the population was rated proportionately by the number of furs they could deliver. This conquest of Siberia was done by very small groups of men, called promyslenniki, a term that referred, as the word handicraft implies, to them being part of the professional guild of trappers and hunters that had existed in Russia since the 14th century. They were small groups. Most promyslenniki bands were no larger than a few hundred. Mostly they were Cossacks, but there were also a great many outlaws or refugees from both the troubles or serfdom amongst them. An expedition into Siberia was a commercial venture. At the beginning of such an expedition, promyslenniki band laid their money together to buy sledges, dogs, fire weapons, and trade goods, such as, of course, above all, vodka. And after they had come back with their booty, such a trading venture would be dissolved again, with the profits of the sales of the goods they had with them to agents of the Tsar being divided amongst the group. These bands were later on followed by Streltsy forces, next by agents of the Tsar, provincial governors or voivodas and clerks, then by merchants, then by peasants seeking a better life, as peasants in Siberia were generally freed from any obligation of serfdom, and then by hordes of other adventure or fortune seekers, ranging from priests and hermits to the artists with their dancing beers and jugglers, the moving 17th century version of the modern Russian circus. And finally, once a regular administration had been put in place in the 18th century by convicts. In 1762, Siberia had a Russian population of 210,000 people and an estimated native one of 1.2 million. Northwards from Tobolsk, promyslenniki bands spread across the Arctic tundra to Turukansk on the Ob River, founded in 1607, place later on used as place of banishment for particularly dangerous political prisoners, including one Joseph Stalin. Eastward to Tomsk on the Tom River in 1604, and from there to Yeniseisk on the Yenisei River in 1619. Battling Ostia, Kirgis and Tungusk tribesmen with their trusty muskets and their occasional guns, by 1621, the entire Yeniseisk, Tomsk stretch was under Russian control. From Yeniseisk, where a wooden fortress was constructed in 1660, the voivode of the Tsar installed for Yeniseisk to become the main center of Russian authority. In that part of Siberia, bands wandered yet further east. In 648, a Cossack band under Hetman Kurbat Ivanov beheld the world's largest body of sweet water, Lake Baikal. I, your slave, sailed down the Lena River, eating fir bark and roots and mare's meat. I then came down to the Yakut land, and there I built a small fort. Thus announced Pyotr Beketov the founding of the new city of Yakutsk in 631, so distant from Moscow that a letter sent there would take more than a year to arrive. It was, altogether, not the most hospitable place. In winters, temperature in Yakutsk dropped to minus 40 centigrade, and the Cossacks were soon starving, since there was absolutely nothing to eat there. We shall leave them there for the moment. With what happened next, we shall deal in the next lecture. Why this entire conquest of Siberia went so quickly is actually rather easy to understand. One is geographical. Siberia is crossed by a system of gigantic rivers that could be used in summer, and the boats could be carried over portages, whereas in winter, frozen taiga could be traversed by dog sledges. The other one is easy to understand too. Once the Russians had newly arrived somewhere, they would round up most of the local population, who were, for obvious reasons, dead afraid of the newcomers. Cossacks were then, and still are, pretty frightening guys, and they were widely rumored amongst the natives to be cannibals besides. So they wanted to get rid of them as soon as possible. They commonly then made some signals to them. There were great riches with the next people. That would commonly tempt a promised Leniki band or a new group of promised Leniki to move on. Though some groups bitterly resisted Russian incursions, the Siberian people were few. They were deeply divided amongst themselves, and some groups were only too glad to help Russians against traditional enemies. They were ravaged by the smallpox, and above all, they had nothing to put against Russian firearms. I ought to add that, as one should expect from any bunch of ruffians, and the promised Leniki sure were ruffians, ruffians who were furthermore all too often starving, and had surely not come a long way to Siberia to stay poor, they burned, they plundered, they raped, and they torched. But once they were done with that, and the tribes nicely brought in their yasak, the Russians left the Siberians pretty much at peace to pursue the life they were used to. In fact, Siberian courts did occasionally protect the native children of the Tsar against abuses of Russian colonists. Aside from which, in southern Siberia, the tribes had already paid yasak to the Mongols before. They merely switched to another overlord. And the Siberian voivodas were instructed to prefer kindness to cruelty, because kindness encouraged a steady flow of furs into the coffers of the Tsar. If people did not deliver their yasak in time, the Cossacks were under order to beat them a little around, and only if that not worked, they were allowed to make war on them, and could take their wives and children as hostages. So, if one compares descriptions of Siberia in the 17th century with those of North America, it is obvious that the Russians, the Yakuts, the Buryats, or the Ifengs were pretty much leading separate lives. By the early 18th century, there were Russian garrison towns with Russian populations, with Russian merchants, with the first wooden churches in Tobolsk or Tomsk. There were Russian peasant villages. But beyond that, the Siberian population pretty much lived the same life as they had always done before, and they occasionally came to the Russian towns to purchase useful things to them, such as axes, sweetmeat, or bread, an interesting alternative to chewing reindeer flesh every day. And while the Russian government did send some missionaries there, yet, as Daniel Defoe observed in his further travels of Robinson Crusoe, all the country between the river Ob and the river Yenisei is pagan, and the people are as barbarous as the remotest of Tartars. I also found, which I observed to the Moscovian governors, whom I had an opportunity to converse with, that the poor pagans are not much wiser or nearer Christianity for being under the Muscovite government, and they acknowledged that was true enough. But that, as they said, was none of their business. If the Tsar had expected to convert his Siberian subjects, it should be done by sending clergymen amongst them, not soldiers. And they added, with more sincerity than I expected, that it was not the concern of the monarch to make the people Christian, as to make them subjects. In other words, the Russians were able to hold vast spaces of Siberia with tiny garrisons of only a few hundred streltsy, because they largely left the Siberian populations undisturbed, if only they paid their yards up. And from these new Russian holdings started to pour out a steady stream of riches that financed Russia's great power status from the 17th century into the present, in a very similar way as the wealth from South America underpinned Spain's great power status, as the Tsar sent a steady stream of particularly German mining engineers or naturalists to Siberia to scout for useful plants and for useful mineral deposits. The Urals iron and copper deposits under the complex of iron works put up by iron master Nikita Demidov, actually a serf, who proceeded to become Russia's wealthiest man, proves that social mobility, though rare, was certainly possible in Tsarist Russia, made Russia in the 18th century the world's main producer of steel. Then there were diamonds from the Urals. And there was silver that made Nyarchinsk in eastern Siberia to Russia's Potosi in the late 18th century. And these veins of silver, it seems to me, financed Russia's war against Napoleon too. As Semen Remezov already predicted, the 17th century, Siberia was to become a wall, an impenetrable rock of Russian power, separated from all Western hordes by its impenetrable width, by its impassable steppes, and by its sea. Siberia, impassable and unknowable, was to become the enduring bulwark of orthodoxy, on whose men and on whose resources the Russian Rodina could forever call in its dire hour of need. Yet if Siberia was isolated from hordes to the west, it had hordes to the south, and two very big and very menacing neighbors, the Mongols and China, and we'll deal with them